In 2001, I first visited my great uncle's grave on the Somme battlefield, and a couple of hours later, I found myself walking the actual part of the battlefield where he was mortally wounded in August of 1916. We talked about this before, but this was a life-changing moment for me, and I know for so many other people who followed in their own ancestors' footsteps across the battlefields of the Western Front, they've had the same feelings. And after that tour, I remember coming home and I was confused. I thought, what do I do now? And I thought, well, I've got to know more, not just about Henry, but I need to know more about the Battle of the Somme that had taken the life of my great uncle. And of course, it changed the history of our family. But where'd you start? You know, I went to the local library. There was hundreds of books about the Battle of the Somme, but one caught my eye. And I reached out for that classic book, The First Day on the Somme, by Martin Middlebrook. I remember I took that book on holiday with me and I didn't speak to anybody as I read it from cover to cover. And then when I finished, I read it from cover to cover again. Then I thought to myself, who was this man, Martin Middlebrook, the author? Who was he? Well, I'm sure everyone's aware by now that Martin died a few days ago, aged 91. And today, in this special podcast from me, Terry Wenham, Tales from the Battlefields, we're going to pay tribute to the great man himself. Many years later, I attended a Western Front Association event in York. By now, Martin was in his 80s, but his talk that day was absolutely incredible. His knowledge of the battle itself was, of course, not surprising. He'd written not just this book, but others. But his memory at that stage of the research he'd undertaken with such care and passion decades earlier, it was just as though he'd only just completed it. It was as though he'd carried out the research just yesterday. Such was his recall, almost photographic. And it occurred to me then when I sat there and listened to him that you can only retain such memories if you're so passionate about the subject you're talking about. You can't make this up. You can't fake it, can you? You can't fake passion. Now, at the end of that meeting, I waited for everyone else to finish talking to Martin. They're all crowding around him. And I nervously approached him. He talked about coming from the Lincolnshire town of Boston, and I told him that my mum's family came from the same place, and from then we just seemed to bond. I suppose he was like that with everybody, but to me it seemed personal. He asked me about my interest in the Great War, and I told him about my great uncle. And as soon as I told him what regiment he was in, what battalion he was in, and the date that he died, he knew exactly what they were doing on that night. He didn't have to look it up, he just knew. And then I asked him to sign my copy of his book. I watched as he wrote, just inside the front cover, "For the memory of Private Henry Wenham, 6 Buffs, 12 Eastern Division, died of wounds 4th of August 1916, buried at Bousincourt Communal." And Martin Middlebrook himself has signed it in that blue biro. Now, I've had my copy of this book for over 20 years and I've read and reread it many times. The pages now are faded brown and some of them have fallen out, but I've stuck them back in again with sellotape. Now, I bought another copy of the book, but I'll never ever part with that original one. It means so much to me, being the first one that I read. I remember actually saying to him, you know, your book was the first one that I read about the Battle of the Somme, about the Great War, and it's that inspired me to continue with my studies. And he looked at me and said, "Do you know how many people have said that to me over the years?" And there was me thinking I was the only one. So why is this book regarded as such an iconic publication? Well, for me, the answer was then still is simple. He wrote about the individual soldier who went over the top on that infamous day, the 1st of July 1916. He didn't write the military account of what happened that day. That'd been done by so many other people. He described who those men were, what their background was, and we followed their story throughout that momentous day. And early on in the book, I think it's within the first 20 pages, there was one particular man that I could relate to. He talked about Charles Matthews, and he was from Northampton, my hometown. What I want to do now is just quote a few passages from Martin's book. So if you've not read it before, if you haven't read it for some time, you get an idea of how he wrote about these individual men. And he says, "Charles Matthews of the Northamptons was posted to a draft for France just 3 months after he'd enlisted. Some heartless army authority refused home leave to Matthews and the other men due for France. They were even confined to their barracks at Colchester. His mother and small sister made the tedious journey from Bletchley to say farewell to their 18-year-old boy, but their meetings had to take place through the railings of the camp gate. This was so distressing that Matthews persuaded his mother to return home. He duly crossed to France as a reinforcement to the 6th Northamptons of the Eastern Division. And then Martin goes on to talk about Charles Matthews, who by this time was a Lance Corporal, and how he spent the last few hours before the battle. He says that Lance Corporal Charles Matthews and his section spent the night in a dugout. They would move to a support trench at dawn. While they waited, an NCO called and ordered one of the Northamptons to the rear. The others were first amazed and then envious to hear that the fortunate man was to go home on leave. Soon after this incident, there was a loud rapport and a bullet ricocheted around the walls of the dugout. A man's rifle had gone off by mistake. After much cursing and shouting, it was discovered that only one man was slightly wounded, the man who had fired the shot. He too went to the rear and was one of the first casualties of the 1st of July. On the next page, Martin continues the story of Charles Matthews. He said he led his section, already depleted by the loss of two men, from their dugout to an assembly trench, behind the assault battalions that they were to support. Matthews did not know that he was directly opposite the mine due to be blown at Casino Point, but as he was not in the front line, he would be some distance from the explosion. Now, the next mention of Matthews comes in the chapter Zero Hour, and it really does, with Martin's superb writing, bring it home to you what those men must have gone through. And in this case, we're not talking about a soldier moving through no man's land. If you remember from the previous passage, Matthews was going to be in support. And Martin takes up the story. He said that Matthews and his section were about 300 yards away from the mine, still in the British reserve trench. The Northamptons knew nothing of the existence of the mine, and the debris blew into the air and started falling. They presumed it was from an enemy mine blown under the British front line. A huge lump of chalk and earth crashed down on the edge of the trench near Matthews and then, disintegrating, fell over him before he could move out of the way. So brutal was the fall that his rifle was broken and he was buried from the waist down. A bag of grenades Matthews had been holding was buried with him. Fortunately, no pins came out and they did not explode. He was the only one wounded and his companions started dragging the rubble away from him. But Matthews was so badly crushed that every movement caused him great pain. A few pages later, Martin tells us that Matthews was buried to his waist in debris and the whistles blew. It was time for his section, which was originally designated a mopping up party, to go over. Matthews' best friend, Bert Smith, was prepared to disobey orders and stay behind to free him. But Matthews ordered Smith to go, assuring him that either stretcher bearers would soon release him or some mortar gunners further down the trench, who had now stopped firing, would come along and help. Reluctantly, Smith left his friend and went over with the rest. The frantic attentions of his friends had been so painful that Matthews preferred to be left for the more leisurely release. Now, as Martin guides us through that day, one of his chapters is called The Review at 8:30. And it tells us that this man from my hometown, Charles Matthews, his ordeal got even worse and is superbly described by Martin. He says, Lance Corporal Charles Matthews, trapped in his trench, had watched his friends go over the top, leaving him alone except for the three mortar gunners who had finished firing and were resting by their mortar. Matthews hoped that soon they would come and release him. And it was at this moment that the German barrage fell on the British trenches, and a shell burst near the resting mortar gunners. Two were killed outright, and a third ran, screaming crazily, down the trench over Matthews, treading on his chest as he went by. Matthews cursed him for his thoughtlessness, but when the gunner had passed, could see that a piece of shell had removed most of the back of the poor man's head. The German shelling continued, and every 4 minutes a salvo of shells burst just outside Matthews' trench. The shelling was so regular that he listened for the plop from well behind the German lines as the battery fired, followed several seconds later by the explosions a few yards away. Matthews realised that if one of the German gun layers elevated his gunner fraction, a shell would burst in his trench and he too would share the fate of the mortar gunners. He was determined to move despite the pain, and using his broken rifle and his one good leg, he started to lever himself upwards. He made some progress, but when halfway up, he could get no further. He His situation was now even more painful, for he could neither free himself nor could he get back to his old position. In this uncomfortable and exposed posture, he had to wait for further developments. In another chapter, which Martin called The Review at Noon, we get more information about what poor Charles was going through. He said, "A shell landed next to me and I was hit all down my left side. I was in insane agony and took a handful of my morphia tablets and was just going to swallow them when one of my men knocked them out of my hand. He said, 'Stop that, you daft bugger.'" And Martin continues the story of Charles Matthews when he says, "Soon after midday, the German shells had been dropping near him all morning ceased. An hour later, he was startled when a duckboard was suddenly thrown across the trench above him and two stretcher bearers crossed with a wounded man. Matthews shouted out to them and asked them to come back for him, and they promised to do so. Another eternity of time passed, and Matthews felt the bearers had forgotten him. But true to their promise, they eventually returned. His helpers' faces fell when they saw his blood-soaked tunic and began cutting it away, fearing he'd got a severe body wound. But they were very pleased when Matthews told them that the blood was not his, that his leg was crushed and that no dressings were needed. With their new load, they laboured over the churned-up ground. With every lurch causing Matthews severe pain, he was very thankful when, after half an hour, he was left at a dressing station in the village square at Carnoy. It was 8 hours since he'd been injured by the mine debris." Martin goes on to tell us what happened to Charles Matthews, and thankfully it does have a good ending. He says that Matthews spent 8 miserable months in military hospitals. His knee was still the size of a football and he could not walk at all. Eventually he was offered a medical discharge and went home, thinking he was crippled for life at the age of just 20. Fortunately for Matthews, a civilian doctor became interested in his injury and he sent him to the Great Portland Street Hospital, where a specialist found that his kneecap was broken into 5 pieces. An operation was performed and Matthews walked out a month later. He was still to have a stiff leg for the rest of his life, but he was able to resume work before the post-war rush for jobs began. It was 6 months after he'd been injured before Matthews discovered that he'd been crushed by debris from a British mine. He'd always assumed that the debris came from a mine exploded by the Germans to hinder the British attack. And Martin finishes talking about Matthews by saying there were many like him. But we also know that after Charles was discharged, he didn't go back to his old office job in the brewery at Northampton. He made a change and he went into banking and he followed that career for the next 40 years. Now, the other thing that appealed to me about that book, The First Day on the Somme, Martin talked about the German experience on that day. There's just one quote that I'd like to read out to you. And it's from the section, the chapter that he called Review at Dusk. Martin says that the German frontline defences had been lost and defenders had suffered heavy casualties. This was obviously in one part of the battlefield in the south. "By the afternoon, we were very low in numbers," said one German defender, "and we were nearly out of ammunition. We took all we could from the dead and wounded, but we were not strong enough to hold out for long. The day closed with another English attack, and we fought standing up in the open. When our last cartridge had been fired, we retreated through the enemy barrage to Bazentin-le-Petit. When the regiment collected in Le Transloy that evening, my company consisted of just 20 men. I was wounded quite early in the morning. I remember lying semi-conscious and seeing British soldiers jumping over our trench, but we were not rounded up and several of us took shelter in a dugout. Once during the morning, an English grenade came down and exploded with a loud crash. No one was hurt, and one of my comrades said, 'Pardon me,' as if he'd made a rude noise, and we laughed. A second grenade followed, and again no one was hurt. Then an English soldier came down, and we all hid in a dark corner, and we weren't seen. It was many hours later that one of our men went out with a white handkerchief, and we were taken prisoner by 2 soldiers from the Devonshire Regiment. They were very friendly, and the doctor who attended me asked where we were from, and I told him Freiburg, and he told me that that's where he'd studied, and he asked me about certain girls that he knew." And that particular story was told by Grenadier Emil Curie of the 109th Reserve Regiment. It's now 20 years since Martin retired from his own battlefield guiding, and I expect that anyone who went on one of those tours, that was a great experience that they'll never forget. Now, I thought that Martin was an experienced professional author when he wrote his book. It's just something I assumed. But no, it turns out he was an egg farmer He wasn't an academic at all, and perhaps that's why I could relate to his style of writing. He used words and phrases that I could actually understand. Apparently, he was very proud of his lack of academic qualifications, and I, for one, can understand that. It doesn't hold you back, does it, in life if you haven't got an academic qualification? It just depends how hard you work and the enthusiasm that you have in any field of work. Now, when I'm out on the battlefields working as a guide, I carry his book with me, especially when I go to the Somme, and I often quote passages like I've done in this podcast. But it's not just the book that is immortal, but Martin himself. And all of us listening to this podcast owe him a tremendous gratitude for the legacy that he's left us all. So now Martin has gone over to join all those soldiers that he told us about in his books. I bet that will be quite a meeting, won't it? Rest in peace, Martin, and a big thank you to you. And we're going to remember him by playing The Last Post.